I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. So glad you could join us. Back in October 1774, delegates from the colonies came to Philadelphia to sign the Declaration of Rights and Grievances. That was followed on July 4, 1776, with the Declaration of Independence and its list of 27 grievances against King George. America was born out of righteous grievance, which has also made us a better country through protest and civil disobedience. Our guest Frank Bruni writes in his new book, The Age of Grievance, that the U.S. may well be the most fascinating laboratory for grievance. He's observed more recently that the country is awash in petty grievances, where slights are often blown out of proportion, where blame and victimhood have outsized appeal, where grievance dominates our politics, our media, even our conversations with each other. Well, today on The Connection, how grievance drives us apart, affects our well-being, hurts our democracy, and what to do about it. Frank Bruni has covered wars, movies, the White House, restaurants, and religion in his many years as a journalist, most of that time at the New York Times. He is currently a professor of journalism and public policy at Duke University and joins us today on The Connection. Nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Well, we are in Philadelphia, so I guess we should start with a little bit of history and the fact that we are a country sort of built on grievance and expressing that kind of grievance.
But grievance then had much different connotations than it has now. One of the things that's so interesting is when you see the word grievance used these days, if you kind of did a Google search and looked at its appearance over the last week, you would find it almost always has a negative connotation. It's a pejorative. And that is one of the tells that our complaints have begun to proliferate, multiply, metastasize in a way that everything is jumbled together, the righteous and urgent causes alongside much, much pettier complaints that are more of a contest of who's a bigger victim. And that's the problem, is we've become increasingly bad at distinguishing between what matters, what must be addressed, and what must find redress, and what we can let go.
Is it a matter then, from your perspective, of reclaiming the word grievance, giving its right due?
We may have spoiled the word grievance forevermore. I don't know that we need to reclaim it. I mean, I like to talk in terms of causes, concerns, and then grievances. Because again, you know, when grievance pops up, what people hear because of the connotations of the moment are whininess, a fetishization of victimhood, that sort of thing.
I must say, though, I think there are plenty of just causes today to be aggrieved about, and whether it's the kind of ostentatious wealth versus the sort of abject poverty that is so much a part of our country, or our politics, or the way we responded to the pandemic. I mean, it seems that there are things that we can be righteously aggrieved about.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you just mentioned one of them, the income inequality in this country, the backward movement or even death of social mobility. I think people are rightly aggrieved about that. The question is, where do you when you're behaving, when you're responding to these grievances, when you're responding to your disappointments, your frustration with your life, where does a legitimate grievance begin to bleed into an illegitimate one and a kind of madness? So take the MAGA movement, for example. Right? It was born in part because there are many Americans, especially in states in the middle of the country, especially in places where factories have shuttered and the economy has been decimated, who feel left behind, who feel like the quote-unquote coastal elites aren't seeing them or caring much about them, and to feel like nobody has traced for them a path back to some level of affluence and opportunity. That is a fair and legitimate perspective. That is a conversation we need to have. When you follow that, as so many of those people have, to the conspiracy theories that they've embraced, to the idea that these coastal elites have rigged the entire election system down to the Dominion voting systems machines, now you're in a different land of grievance. You're in a fantasy land of grievance, and you're in a place from which we cannot have constructive, meaningful national conversations.
You define grievance, and I think it's important to know what it is, what we're talking about, and to have a definition. is an overwrought complaint that demands a solution that is disproportionate to the problem. I'm probably paraphrasing you there. Mm-hmm. Does that speak to what we're talking about?
Sure. I mean, January 6th comes to mind, those riots. That demanded a solution disproportionate to the real problem. The real problem is the one I talked about a moment ago, the fact that many Americans feel left out and to some degree are left out. I mean, it is true that a portion of America has condescended to another portion. But when your demand is that they not certify an election in which court after court said, no, we do not see the kinds of irregularities here that you're alleging. No, we do not think this election result has been corrupted. When you're saying, regardless, I demand you lawmakers that you not certify this. I demand that Donald Trump remain in office. You are now looking for a solution, a bit of action that is disproportionate to the problem because you've invented the problem.
Well, you say that the kind of grievance that we're talking about is a confluence of pessimism and narcissism.
Yes.
Interesting combo there.
Well, I think a lot has happened in our society over recent decades that has turned us inward. We spend so much time looking at our own lives, asking the question what we individually are owed, just kind of focused entirely on self, self, self. And when you marry that to a whole new American pessimism, you end up with a recipe for frustration, for agitation, for indiscriminate agitation. This pessimism thing is something I don't think we fully reckoned with. This country has always been fundamentally optimistic. Sometimes the mythology of that is a little bigger than the actuality of it. But if you look back at our history, there's this notion the most optimistic candidate often won. That was true. That's not true anymore.
No, it isn't.
I mean, Donald Trump won, in quotation marks. He didn't win the popular vote. He won by being as dark and gloomy a candidate as I've ever seen. I'll tell you something that is a really good distillation of this change in the American psyche and really disturbing. For many decades now, several times a year, Gallup asks Americans, are you generally satisfied with life in this country and with the direction of this country? And up until 2004, you regularly had returns from that poll that were above 50%. You know, the line went up and down, but repeatedly and regularly, you had more than 50% of Americans saying, yes, I'm generally satisfied. Since 2004, that's 20 years running, that result has never crested 50%. Hmm. It has been below 50% and most often below 40 or 35% for 20 straight years. That is a whole new American pessimism that is a breeding ground for pitting people against one another, for everyone feeling like it's a zero-sum game. If you're winning, I must be losing.
I'm thinking of all the things that then have happened in the last 20 years that might feed that kind of pessimism.
Much has happened. I mean,
wars, pandemic.
Let's just go 4 years from 2004 to 2008, right? We had the near collapse of the global economy. You know, we had the complete collapse of the housing market for many Americans. I mean, that was a big moment.
But they still haven't dug out from many
still,
of them.
Still haven't dug out from it, nor have they forgotten the bailout of the big banks. I mean, we talked about income inequality a while back. I think 2008 stands to a lot of Americans as a moment when they saw that there are certain people who are exempt from the rules, who are almost exempt from the laws of gravity, economically speaking, and others who aren't. I think that frustration, that resentment, and the wounds of that, the very real wounds in terms of personal wealth, have not gone away.
And that's also the year we elected our first black president.
Correct.
How does that feed into, I mean, for some people, that was a kind of optimism that they could not imagine in their lifetime.
For some people, it was. I remember being teary on the night of his election because it said, and it wasn't so much about personal fandom of Barack Obama, whom I do admire and I did admire then. It was about what it said about our country and the progress we were making. And it seemed so true, so incredibly true to what America at its best is, a true land of opportunity and a true kind of theater of the best kind of diversity. But there, I think, are many Americans who were disturbed by that, unsettled by that. And I think that has fed this as well. It's a complicated phenomenon, though, because I do think there were as many Americans who were exuberant about voting for him as those who were who felt like this meant a change in complexion to the country that they couldn't quite get comfortable with. But those Americans, I think their disorientation, their disappointment, whatever the right noun for it is, I think that has held for a long time.
And that also coincides with Donald Trump saying that Barack Obama was not a real American, mm-hmm. was not born in this country. And I wonder how you think that fed a kind of pessimism, but also a kind of a grievance.
Well, it's a distillation of what has become well beyond Donald Trump and across the ideological and political spectrum. It's the distillation of us versus them politics, right? Increasingly, the way candidates well beyond Donald Trump, although few are as cynical and as depraved, sorry, as he is, it has become the norm for a politician to campaign with us versus them language, to say, vote for me, because otherwise they will prevail, and you don't like them, and they don't like you, and they're not going to treat you kindly. And I don't see in many campaigns over the last decade the kind of idealism that mm-hmm. once used to be such an animating force in American politics. And as our leaders behave, so do we. I mean, they model a kind of behavior that we then have a permission for, and we often end up emulating, even if we're not doing so consciously.
You're right, though, that Donald Trump, and I'm quoting here, was grudge made flesh, grievance become president.
100%. He said to people, look at the way the elites are treating me. Look at the way they're talking about me. Let me tell you how they've ostracized me my whole life. You feel they've done that to you? Vote for me, and that is the way you take your revenge against them.
I am your retribution.
Well, he didn't say that until like a year and a half ago. But yeah, right. That's pretty much his re-election slogan. I don't know, do we call it a re-election? There was a pause. But yeah, I mean, that was him boiling down to what is that, four words, I am your retribution, to mm-hmm. four words as bluntly as possible, what has been his sales pitch all along. The enemy of my enemy is, you know, it is very much, it's the own the libs phrase, right? You want to own the libs, vote for me. In fact, we even have a kind of grievance economy in which the whole reason Truth Social exists and the whole reason its stock goes up and down based on nothing seemingly, except when its stock is going up, it's people saying, I'm going to own a piece of Truth Social because that's a way of owning the libs. If that does well, it will drive my political enemies crazy, and that's good enough for me.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Frank Bruni is our guest today on The Connection. He's got a brand new book we're talking about. It's called The Age of Grievance. And Frank Bruni, longtime journalist, writes a weekly column for The New York Times. And we're going to take a very short break. We'll be back to our conversation, talking about a whole host of things, even beyond Donald Trump. So do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about why so many people feel so angry, so outraged, so resentful these days. And our guest is New York Times columnist Frank Bruni. He's explored our culture of complaint, the kind of blame game that we see and hear around us. And he's joining us today on The Connection to talk about his new book called The Age of Grievance. You touched on this earlier, but I want to just dig a little bit deeper. And I remember in the 70s, the me generation, the idea of these young people coming up, they're lazy and they're all about themselves. And I think in some ways, older generations do say that about younger generations. But what I got from reading your book is you think there's some truth to something that happened in the 70s that we're experiencing today, the kind of narcissism you referenced earlier.
Yeah, there was this whole new phenomenon that I don't know if we called it this in the 70s, but it certainly appeared then in a whole new way, which is like this idea of self-actualization. Like the work I need to do to make my life as good as it can be is on me. You know, I need to focus on me and I need to make the best me. And that is a sentiment that is in tension with the collective good. And I write a lot in the book. I feel like the notion of the collective good has really vanished in large measure from American political debate, from our civic discourse. But yeah, so it's funny. When I was editing the book with my editor, he said, no, I think you're wrong. The me generation, the me decade was the 70s. And he said, no, the me decade was the 80s. And I went back to check my notes and check my work. No, the me decade was the 1970s. It was declared as such by Tom Wolfe in a cover story for New York Magazine. But I think you could argue every decade since has felt like the me decade, because we may be living in the me millennium. I mean, we've gone from self-actualization to self-care. That's a whole new term, right? And a whole new ethos and value. And that's fine to a point. But I think we're spending so much time looking inward, asking about how I am faring in the world, asking about what the world owes me or how it's shortchanging me, that I think that makes it very, very difficult to have meaningful political conversations.
Well, I do want to get to that, but just to sort of rest here for a moment, I think the argument could be made that going into therapy, doing self-help, making oneself a better person, I mean, if the goal is to be then a better neighbor, a better friend, a better member of the family, a better citizen, then I think that's something we could all get behind. But you're saying it's, what, too much navel gazing, too much me?
I mean, I'm not in everybody's therapy session, nor would they want me there, nor would I have the time.
I don't think you'd be allowed either, yeah. But that's okay.
I think that would be against all medical and psychotherapeutic ethics, et cetera. But I mean, it does seem to me like a lot of this therapy is navel gazing. And I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I hope people are going and saying, you know, I'm here because I want to learn how to be a better citizen. But I mean, I just think there's a self-referential aspect to modern life. Social media abets it in an enormous way. When you're on Instagram, when you're on TikTok, a lot of what you're doing is kind of sculpting, promoting a brand. I mean, think about that. People think of themselves these days as never before as brands. We're not talking about Nike as a brand. We're talking about me and my TikTok handle. I don't mean Frank Bruni. I'm not on TikTok, but as a brand. That encourages a magnitude, an intensity of self-consciousness that I do think factors into our grievance culture.
Well, these are the influencers who apparently are influencing people, but it often makes the observer feel badly about themselves because they don't have the $400 pair of shoes.
Well, I mean, we share only a portion of our lives on social media, and we tend to share the portions of our lives that inspire envy. I mean, to go by Instagram or TikTok, everybody every weekend is at a wedding in the Caribbean clinking champagne flutes while the sun sets behind them. You know, nobody posts on their TikTok or their Instagram or whatever their platform of choice is. Nobody posts a picture of themselves under the covers after a really terrible day and a romantic spat covered in the buttered popcorn that they ate too much of while there are tears rolling down their cheeks. That probably happens much, much more often than the wedding in the Caribbean. But you don't see that on Instagram or TikTok. And so I think all of us are left with a sense that everybody else is living a wonderful life and we've been left behind.
I remember years ago, this shows you how old I am, doing an interview about this thing called the internet, before there was an internet. And the whole notion was, this will connect us, you know, that we're a big world out there and we're all going to come together, this great sort of democratic experience that we're going to have. I think there's a piece of that, but so much of the internet disconnects us, pulls us apart.
Yeah, it was the great promise of connectedness
that became
the nightmare and cautionary tale of disconnectedness. It is so much a part of our problem right now when it comes to grievance culture, because what the internet has enabled us to do in tandem with cable television. I mean, remember, I don't know, I'm probably older than you are, but when I was in my teens and you wanted to watch TV news, you had three or four choices.
Absolutely.
It was ABC, CBS, NBC, and then maybe, depending on where you were, a PBS station, right? And that was hardly ideal, and there were a lot of problems with the monoculture of the news then. But at least it meant most of us were operating from and having our disagreements in the realm of a set of common facts. Like, truth itself wasn't up for grabs the way it is now. Because of the internet, because of the proliferation of cable channels, each of us has an information and news diet that is distinct from the news diet of the person sitting to our right, the person sitting to our left. And so we're living in these vastly different and often conflicting realities that make it very difficult to get along, to forge common ground, to work toward compromise. And you see this in our paralyzed, constipated legislatures, and you see this in the nastiness of our political debates.
Let me quote you here, and this is talking about grievance. What the left feels and the right feels are identical, oppressed. There's a perverse mirror image tidiness to it, a nasty reciprocity, even a strange symbiosis. So you're saying both sides guilty as charged?
Both sides are – there are – actors on both sides, when I say actors, I mean citizens, politicians on both sides, who are approaching the world in a very dangerous way, approaching their political engagement, everything in a very dangerous way, which is, let me take stock of how I'm slighted, of how I've been wronged. Let me identify who's done that to me, and then let me plot my revenge. You see that across the political spectrum. Now, I want to be careful here because this is very difficult to write and talk about, and I try to be very careful in the book, and you'll tell me whether I succeeded or not. Well, this behavior, this dynamic, this dangerous psychology exists in a nonpartisan or all-partisan way. I think the manifestations of it on the right at this point in time are much scarier and much more destructive than on the left. It is on the right that we see the preponderance of organized political violence. It is on the right that we see election denialism of such intensity and magnitude that we had the January 6th riot. I don't see that in the same measure or nearly the same measure on the left. So I'm not doing a false equivalence here. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, there are people on the left who are so addicted to their sense of oppression, who see that oppression everywhere they look, places where it exists, places where it doesn't exist. And in that sense, they have some common sets of practices and habits of mind as the MAGA movement.
Who are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about some social justice warrior progressives who bend every set of circumstances to their narrative and to what they're promoting. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
When horrifically, Brittany Griner was imprisoned in Russia, right? You could find, not just on social media, but you could find this in some commentary on the left, you could find the complaint that she was languishing and that not much was being done about it because of racism, sexism, and homophobia, because she's black, because she's lesbian, and because she's a woman. Okay. Racism is an enormous problem in our society,
sure. As
is sexism, as is homophobia. No argument here. In fact, radical agreement here. Brittany Griner was better known to me and most Americans, as was her fate, and she was getting a lot of attention publicly from the Biden administration, not because they were trying to champion those minority groups, but because she was a celebrity, right? But when you go into the public square, as some people did, and say, here again, I see racism, sexism, homophobia, you are giving people who want to tune you out a reason to, because they hear that and they think that's ridiculous. Mm. You are surrendering and eroding your own credibility. And that becomes a problem because you want that credibility when you're making those claims in those situations where those claims are urgent and necessary.
Knowing, of course, she has been released, wrote a memoir, and where she talks, as I understand it, about other Americans who are stuck in the gulag in Russia.
We right. Most Americans only know, and they probably forgot it already, and that's, I mean, we have a lot of things to remember, but most Americans first heard the name Paul Whelan. who is still in prison there and had been imprisoned there for several years, also a political prisoner, also someone the Russians were detaining just to kind of stick it to us and make a point. But you didn't, and he's a white man, but you'd never heard about him until Brittany Griner came along. So when people on the left were saying and writing that, that is an example of grievance run amok.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Frank Bruni, our guest today on The Connection. And he's got a new book we're talking about. It's called The Age of Grievance. You also write about university campuses, not all of them, obviously, but where trigger warnings and microaggressions and canceling, you know, speakers and obviously all the turmoil that's going on currently, where that is really a place where there's a fight about language and about identity. Oh, you just rolled your eyes at me.
I rolled my eyes when you said language.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's
And I'll explain why. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you teach at a university. Language matters. Language can hurt. Language can have disastrous consequences to people.
Yes.
Why did you roll your eyes?
I rolled my eyes because everything you said is true, and because when, and we see this coming out of some universities, Stanford came out with this, I'm going to get the name wrong, I mentioned it accurately in the book, a hurtful language glossary or a harmful language glossary. And there again, by coupling important things with silly things, you end up undermining the whole effort. That language glossary, I believe, and just about everyone I've seen, because some corporations have come out with these, tells people they shall not use the word blind in phrases like blind faith and blind study, because that is deeply wounding and offensive to people with vision impairments. Okay. I had a stroke 5.5 years ago. I lost sight in my right eye, and I was told that what was learned about my kind of anatomy, et cetera, I live with a 20% chance of going blind, right? When someone says blind faith or blind study to me, I am not offended because I am exposed to this thing called metaphor, right? Let us not wage these silly battles because, again, as I said earlier, when we then turn towards serious battles, we've given people a reason to tune us out because it all just sounds like so like a din.
You're talking about what, neutering language? I mean, are there certain words you think, you know, white people shouldn't say the N-word, for instance?
Of course they shouldn't say that, and I don't think anyone should use the F-word for gay lesbian people. I mean, we can't really go through the list of words, but we know what hurtful and absolutely unacceptable, impermissible words are. And to put them on a list with stuff like blind study and blind faith, or there was one that said you should never use the adjective brave because some people will hear a put down of Native Americans in that word. I don't think most people hear that. And I think when you start kind of coming up with these rules and the censorship, I think it's answered with censorship from other quarters that you don't want. It just creates a climate that is not doing us much good.
Do you then see a connection between what's happening on some of these campuses and people going to libraries because they want to ban certain books because of certain content or something about the author that offends them?
Well, I think there's a kind of push-pull in a contest. Like, if you're going to be censorious according to your values, I'm going to be censorious according to my values. Again, I'm not drawing an equivalence. Yeah. I think there's a big difference between asking people not to say blind faith or blind study and taking important works of literature off the shelf because there's like one sex scene or an interracial marriage in it that you think children shouldn't be exposed to. These are not the same things. Right. But they spring from a similar impulse that I think we need to discourage, which is just this sort of runaway, exaggerated censoriousness, this desire to kind of patrol and police behavior where it really needn't be patrolled and policed because we have more important matters to attend to.
You raise an interesting, and it's a little bit of a personal point here about who is the oppressor and who is the oppressed. You're a white gay man. Mm-hmm. So are you both? Are you neither? I mean, you raise this in that people are obviously a complicated mix of various identities.
Yeah, well, I write about it in the context of you can find in a lot of discussions. I found it in a kind of a faculty development seminar that I volunteered to take about how to run a kind of better, more diverse classroom, which isn't. I took the seminar because that's really important. And one of the materials used, and it's used in a lot of other contexts, was this hierarchy of oppression, where it basically said, If you belong to X group, you are most oppressed. If you belong to X group, you are the next most. I mean, it literally ranked it like that. And there's obviously some present and historical truth to it, but it's so reductive, right? And the point I was making in writing about myself is, am I a creature of privilege or am I someone who understands marginalization? Mm-hmm. It's complicated. I'm a white person who grew up in the upper middle class. Dad put an in-ground pool in the backyard. That's pretty posh, right? I'm also someone who knew he was gay at 11, 12 years old in a much different country and lived with an enormous amount of fear that I would have a difficult, difficult life, that I would be judged and dismissed and ostracized by many people I met if they know the truth about me. So am I someone who should be apologizing for my privilege, or am I someone who is actually attuned to the opposite of privilege? The answer is both. And that's true of so many people, and I'm just urging us not to kind of try to organize the world into such neat and tidy boxes, because that is not life and that is not people.
You use the word complicated, and you write that you say this to your students where you teach at Duke University, which is you're often going to say to them, it is complicated.
That's right. I make very clear to them that I am not someone who is serving up verities to them. I'm like an ambassador of ambivalence and uncertainty. No, I mean, because some things are uncomplicated, right?
Yes.
It is not complicated to look at the people who marched in Charlottesville, the good people on both sides, according to Donald Trump. It is not complicated to say that the people who were saying Jews will not replace us and who were identifying themselves as white nationalists and white supremacists, it's not contemplated to say that has no place in America. Right. But a lot of other things are complicated. And I just want us, I want each of us to be less always certain that we're right. I want us to be open to the fact that each of us is occasionally wrong, that other people have the right to disagree with us in most instances. That doesn't mean they're our sworn enemies. It doesn't mean they are the enemies of America. It doesn't mean they're amoral. And can we just turn the temperature down a little bit in those situations where that's okay?
We're almost about a break here, but does grievance give us this illusion of certainty that if I am aggrieved, if I have been wronged, then I see the world in sort of black and white terms?
I think it's the other way around. I think faux certainty, an unearned certainty, is the sire of our grievances.
The fact that we think we're so right all the time.
I know I'm right about this, and you're disagreeing with me, and that oppresses me. That is disrespectful to me.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Frank Bruni. He does teach at Duke University and a longtime member of the press, has a weekly column now for the New York Times, and he's covered just about everything when it comes to journalism, from war to movies to restaurants. And he's got a new book we're talking about, and it's called The Age of Grievance. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
I'm Artie Moscowen, and on The Connection today, a conversation with New York Times columnist Frank Bruni about our culture of complaint. And again, he's got a new book. It's called The Age of Grievance. Well, talking about grievance, let's talk about the media. And let me play a clip, and you actually lead your book with this story. And this is Fox News host Sean Hannity. And this is back in 2022. He's criticizing the Biden administration's response to the baby formula shortage. Let's give it a listen.
Biden's preferential treatment for illegals, it's gotten worse because, according to Florida Congresswoman Kat Kamick, new photos inside a migrant facility, this one in McAllen, Texas. Look at that. Pallets and pallets of baby formula for illegal immigrants and their families. Even as hardworking American families, we are now suffering a massive a nationwide formula shortage.
Lie. Frank Bruni. That is wrong. Incorrect.
Oh, he was totally wrong. Yeah. And what was so funny, well, not funny at all, actually, about that was someone at CNN had the good sense to zoom in on the photo of those pallets and pallets of baby formula. And they weren't baby formula. They were actually powdered milk for older children. And that was not in short supply. And the Biden administration was not rerouting baby formula from quote unquote hardworking American families to these horrid migrants. I'm channeling Sean Hannity with that description. They weren't doing that. But it's such an emblematic moment because so much of what happens in politics these days, and certainly so much of what happens in at Fox News, is the creation and perpetuation of this us versus them narrative. Somebody else is being privileged over you, and that's why you're so under the gun. They have it easy. They've rigged the system. You are victimized. That's exactly the mentality that he was distilling in that completely fallacious news segment.
And, of course, Fox News was sued for, close to $1 billion.
They settled for $787.5 million, by far the biggest defamation settlement ever.
Related to the election, of course.
Related to the election, but that is such an important story because why did they have to settle for that money? Why were they looking at even worse if they went to a jury trial? Because the discovery process in that lawsuit, which was filed by Dominion Voting Systems, the discovery process revealed that Fox executives, Fox anchors, knew that they were putting on air rank lies about the rigging of voting machines. They knew these were nutty conspiracy theories. They admitted this to one another, but they said, we've got to air it anyway, because if we don't, our consumers, our customers, our audience will just go to some other place that will tell them that. Think about what that means about our media ecosystem right now. You go shopping for the version of reality that you want. You don't find a trusted, not everyone, but many people, they don't find a trusted source having kind of done a little bit work to make sure it's trustworthy and then receive in an open-minded way what it's telling them. They decide what they want to be the truth, and then in this crazy marketplace, they go find the news vendor who's going to give that to them. Wow.
Confirmation bias, right? We seek
on
out
steroids.
We seek out the news and information that makes us feel that we're right about the world.
Or that we're being wrong.
Or that we're being wrong,
that we are exactly as victimized as we've decided we are.
I mean, this is potentially or maybe actually highly dangerous.
I think it's one of the greatest threats we face as a democracy right now, because again, if we don't have at least some overlap in the facts that we're talking about, some overlap in our versions of reality, how do we ever get out of these cycles of rancor and recrimination and constant battling?
You also write about, and this is, I guess, about the false idea of certainty, the role of pundits and ambiguity, and you even write about the fact that as a pundit yourself from time to time, you have sort of fallen into this trap of certainty.
I've always had, to this moment, I have misgivings about being a pundit, whatever that is. And I hope, I try to behave a little bit more responsibly than I might otherwise. I probably fail a lot. But I think we're supposed to be merchants of certitude, those of us who are pundits. And so we end up, I think, mustering and communicating a degree of certainty, even in instances where we're not that certain or where certainty is not possible. I think the media encourages those of us who write to reach hasty conclusions. Shades of gray don't draw as many clicks as shades of black and white do. And that is a problem because that encourages people also to eschew ambiguity, to turn their back on shades of gray, to feel a certainty beyond whatever they have reason to.
Let me quote you. I worry, too, about how frequently we shove ambivalence and ambiguity aside. Ambivalence and ambiguity aren't necessarily signs of weakness or sins of indecision. They can be apt responses to events we don't yet understand with outcomes we can't predict.
That's right. I was struck, for example, right after October 7th, how quickly various people bent that narrative. We still were learning things. You know, it was a moving story, but how quickly, days afterwards, people just took whatever part of that confirmed their political agenda, confirmed their quote-unquote brand, and ran with that. And I kept thinking to myself, something this horrific, something that's clearly going to be this consequential, can we ever just all sit back for a week, absorb the information, think it through before we go to our battlements, raise the flags we always raise, and begin shouting at one another?
You also say grievances create an environment for conspiracy theories to take hold, which I think, if you think about it, makes a lot of sense, right?
Oh, sure.
I mean, it's a way of explaining things that feel inexplicable.
Conspiracy theories are hugely reassuring. If let's take the 2020 election, if you are distressed by the fact, if you're someone who voted for Trump and who believes the country's going in the wrong direction, and you're freaked out about so-called wokeism and all that, and you look up and many million more people have voted for Joe Biden, you don't want to believe that your thinking is in the minority. So what do? You find these conspiracy theories that say, oh no, there may have been space beams monkeying with the voting machines. There were all these illegal immigrants who were bused to the polling stations, right? These are very reassuring because they tell you not that you are in a minority or that the world is moving away from you. They tell you that these dark plots are only making it seem that way to you.
Because you are right.
Because you are right and everybody else is wrong.
I wonder, too, whether, you know, AI, which is, you know, slowly it seems like it's taking over our reality, whether that will make it then harder for us to know what's true, what's false, what's real, what's not, and how that could feed either conspiracy theories or grievance.
Yes, and it's going to be clearly a very potent tool for the agents of disinformation.
Yeah.
You know, we're already having situations where, I mean, we've seen this in a couple of recent big news stories, including October 7th, where photographs end up in the public realm, and it turns out that they are completely fictive, right? But until that is said, people are looking at them, responding emotionally to them. It's a very scary situation.
Well, we've spent about 45 minutes diagnosing the problem. You say that humility is an antidote to grievance. But humility, I mean, you can't just all of a sudden be humble. I mean, it has to come from some deep place.
Well, where it can and should come from, and where I think it very likely will come from, is the recognition that we're in a very dysfunctional place as a country. And I spend the last portion of the book, because I think it's so important, saying here's how we can be better, and proposing a number of things we can do, because there are things we can do in the realm of political reform, in the realm of education, in the realm of social media regulation. There's a lot we can do to push back at this grievance run amok, at this grievance culture. It starts, though, with saying we can't go on like this, and one of the ways that we will not go on like this is if each of us recognizes in a humble fashion that I do not get a world entirely to my liking, that every disappointment I encounter is not an injustice, that other people are entitled to different opinions, and that it's okay if they disagree with me. I mean, those are postures of humility that I think have gone missing in large segments of our public life.
But that does require some deep soul searching. I mean, to say it's hard to admit when we're wrong or we have ideas that don't really match the world or our reality.
I would ask every listener to say, when you look back at something you said or did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, don't you see some misperceptions in some of the stuff you said and did? Haven't you become smarter and grown? And if that's the case, vis-a-vis 10 years ago, that will be the case 10 years hence.
We're in the middle of a political season, as we all know. I mean, it never stops, but nonetheless, this is a big election year. Is it possible to have humility in the face of a national presidential election?
Well, in the face of this election, it is tough. But, I mean, yes, I would say advocate, campaign fervently for what you want to happen and for what you believe must happen. But you can be fervent without being ferocious. You can be more thoughtful than spiteful in your advocacy, because there's going to be a result and we're going to have to live with it and we're going to have to live with one another. So let's not create an atmosphere that's so toxic that there's no way to work with it.
Without being overtly political, but I think it's just a reality. You've got two major candidates, obviously Trump, the grievance candidate, and you've got Biden, who at least on paper and I think in policy appeals to something more connective, more benign, if I can put it that way. I mean, how do you stay humble with those two choices?
Well, what I would say is I think your characterization of Trump versus Biden is correct. One of the things that I think we might see happen during this campaign, and one of the things I worry about, is I think you may see Biden leaning harder and harder into grievance, because we do seem to be at a moment in time where anger is the primary motivating force for voters. And so I think it's going to be very tempting for him to paint an ever more nightmarish picture of Trump and his supporters, and to say to the people whom he wants to vote for him, look at the dark tide coming your way. You know, this is evil. This is horrible. You are about to be oppressed beyond your wildest imaginings. Time to rise up.
I mean, one does hear that, I think, coming from the more liberal left-wing press, which is that if Trump wins, or even if he loses, we're going to be dealing with fallout that goes on forever.
Absolutely. And there are concrete things that are of huge concern. I believe very fervently in reproductive rights. I believe in abortion rights. And I think if Trump wins, those are very much at risk. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's all over the map on this. But fight. But I don't think the fight is going to work out better if much of it is predicated on name-calling of the other side. I think part of what has fed the MAGA and Trump movement is a sense that everybody condescends to them and treats them as caricatures.
Rather than
as people who have a different view that we disagree with strongly, and that we are in a civil way fighting against, in a civil way, no January 6th, et cetera.
What, you mentioned political reform, and you have some ideas, including bringing more humility to our politics. And there are people, I think, who operate out of that mindset. At the same time, there are plenty of examples of the kind of inhumility, if there is such a word, at play in our politics.
But we've seen some hopeful things happen. I mean, there was a terrific story the New York Times ran about 2 or 3, 4 weeks ago. I lose track of time, about changes in Michigan that had made it over the past five years a much more Democratic state. They found a way to chip away at and end gerrymandering. They went from a state in which the legislature did not seem to resemble the political leanings of Michigan citizens to one that did. I mean, it's a fascinating story, because we keep on throwing up our hands and saying gerrymandering, can't do anything about it. Minority rule, can't do anything about it. Michigan did, and it happened because enough concerned citizens use the levers available to them. We can change this country. We just have to have the will, and we have to have the stamina.
How about education?
Education, we need at a much earlier age to begin talking to young people about the way they set up and use their social media feeds. I've learned this in the classrooms at Duke. When I talk to my students about what they mean for their social media feeds to be doing for them, how they want to be informed versus what it actually looks like, you find out that when they're living in these echo chambers, they actually didn't tuck themselves into those echo chambers in a super conscious way. Like, they made a few choices, the algorithms kicked in, and then nobody ever said, let's pause and look at what's happened, mm-hmm. and let's ask ourselves if it's aligned with who you want to be and how you want to be informed, and then let's make some alterations. That sort of conversation has to begin happening with young people at a very early age.
You quote, I think her name is Jean Twenge. She's
yeah.
a psychologist. And you quote her saying, for America to work, you have to have optimism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You quoted that because you believe it?
I totally believe that. And because I believe one of the real problems, as we discussed earlier, is the turn toward pessimism in our country. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe things can be better, you won't work to make things better. If you don't believe that the future could be bright, you're going to buy into a zero-sum game where you are in competition with your neighbor for scant resources, not in collaboration with your neighbor for making this a more perfect union.
Do you have a grievance then about the grievance culture?
I guess I am aggrieved by grievance culture, yeah. But I'm not just stewing in it. I wrote a book. I'm trying to do something about it.
Well, we got to leave it there. Frank Bruni, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you.
And again, Frank Bruni has been our guest. His new book is titled The Age of Grievance. And he has had many different jobs as a journalist. He covered the White House. He covered restaurants, covered wars, covered religion, covered movies as well. And he's a professor now of journalism and public policy at Duke University, writes a weekly column for The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us. And for more information about The Connection, go to whyy.org/The Connection. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. And check out our website, whyy.org/The Connection, for more information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Debbie Bilder produces The Connection along with Paige Murray Bessler. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Thank you so much. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.